This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
And this is Warren Mundine, Chair, Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council at the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, held September 5th, 2016. This is broad.
We are very fortunate to welcome Warren Mundine to speak with us today. Warren is the Chair of the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council and is a highly respected and influential businessman, political strategist and Indigenous advocate for empowering Indigenous Australia to build a sustained Indigenous economy. His life and career have been shaped by a personal commitment to community, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, and he has more than 26 years' experience working in the public, private and community sectors. Can you please welcome Warren?
Thanks for that. It's always good to get your mother to write the introduction. It's a bit embarrassing, actually. Anyway, before I kick off, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're on today, the Wurundjeri people and all of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present and future, as well as my own Bundjalung nation as well, and on my mother's side, the Yulbanga Yuin people, and of course, a little bit of a touch of the Irish, which I enjoy as well. I'd like to I'll give a quick background of myself so it gives you a bit of a picture, then talk about what the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council is about and what its role really is, because there's a lot of conversations about it. And then I'll get on to the issues of what the work we're carrying out, and discuss some of the things that were raised today as well as the things that will be raised over the next day and a half. First of all, I'm a bit of a simple guy. If people know me, I come from a engineering trade background. I was a turner and then worked on gas pipelines and stuff like that. And so I have a very simple approach to things. Sort of like if you see a problem, you just fix the problem. You just don't sit around worrying about it. You just have a cup of tea and then you get out there and fix it. There's a roll up your sleeves kind of type bloke. And I got that from my mum and dad. My dad, who was 6'3", was a very old fashioned man of the Great Depression. But he's unfortunate life, he married a woman who was 4'11". And people know short women, they're pretty tough, and was very determined for her kids to have a better life than the life that she had. So, because when they first got married, they lived in the riverbank, the Jack Adrey, up on the Man River, just west of Grafton, in a tent. And they lived there for many years. Dad would disappear every now and again doing different bits of work, and she brought us all up. I'm one of 11 kids, three of whom were girls. The other eight were boys, which probably brought the reason why my mother was so tough, trying to control eight boys who were crazy country boys. But also, she was a very strong feminist before I think the word feminist was invented. She got her daughter, my eldest daughter, Anne, in 1959, an Aboriginal woman, to work in the bank as a teller and past school. She got a second daughter, also Olive, to work in a bank, and then went on to be a model for David Jones. And David Jones, in the anniversary, the 150th anniversary, two years ago, actually had an exhibition to my sister. It was in the 1960s. It was probably one of the first Aboriginal models, and also working in the banking system. And then my third sister, who just passed away only a few weeks ago, she also started work in the rural bank and worked her way up there, then went on to the New South Wales Public Service Commission and also worked as in the Public Service Commission, the Federal or Commonwealth Public Service Commission as well. So, and but that, and we had a wonderful, us boys, we're the younger ones, the boys are all the younger ones. We had this incredible model of women's success and how to treat women. And they were just marvellous sisters to have. Men couldn't have had better sisters because at Sydney University, they also, in those days, there's a Colombo plan, so there's a lot of Asian students at the university. They were pretty lonely kids at the university, so my mum and my sisters had a deal. They could come and stay at our place, but they had to cook a meal, and so we had our house was always full of people, 13 of us, plus these Malaysian, Indonesian, Singaporeans, and so on, coming backwards and forwards. In fact, every time I smell peanut oil, I'm always thrown back to my early childhood. And of course, in those days, in the 60s, my sister, my mum, even though she was a feminist, still had a good Catholic girl, didn't let our daughters just wander out dating all the time, used to get us boys to go along with them, us younger boys, sort of like to make sure there's no hanky-panky. But we had a great childhood. We went to parties and went to dances and went to beaches and went everywhere. And every time my sisters were in between boyfriends, we'd be in their ear about find a boy, we want to go out somewhere. So that's where we got out. That's where my sort of background is, a very simple background. I'm a lover of KISS, not the band, Keep It Stupid Simple, because I'm the last guy in the end, simple. Very outcome driven and a simple bloke. And I have a very, and of course my sisters and my mother were very strong women. From a very early age, in the 60s and that, we were brought up very outspoken on violence, especially violence against women. In fact, one of the ironies of my mother's statement was, if I ever catch you punching a girl, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. So, which is quite interesting. But anyway, so she was very... So I always had a very strong view about women, about how they were, and about the equality and the opportunities of women. So when I was asked in 2013 to be head of the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council, I wanted to take a different view about where we were heading in this area, and there's very strong viewpoints that I wanted. And I actually said no to him. That was Abbott, previous Prime Minister. I said no to him. I didn't want to be in a talk fest type thing. I wanted to actually have something meaty to do. And so he said, well, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, one is looking at this community safety space, which we wanted to look at, about violence against women, violence against kids and abuse, and about how we handle that. I wanted to look at how do we get socioeconomic changes, so how do we get economic participation and development for Indigenous communities, and how do you do that? And so one of the major parts of that, of course, is in education and so on. So they're the three areas that we chose. There was a fourth area that Abbott tossed on the end, which is looking at the constitutional amendment stuff, which I'm pleased the current Prime Minister took off us and gave it to someone else, so we have our focus on those areas. And we didn't want to necessarily get caught up in spending. We wanted to look at how do we focus on these certain areas so that we could make Indigenous communities safe, make Indigenous women safe, and give the opportunities that need to be happening in that space. And of course, that meant about it, how do we start designing and shifting things. And of course, when you have a revolution about change and you're trying to change a culture, it's always very interesting about how people react to some of these things and get scared. For instance, we did an audit, we looked at the Aboriginal Affairs base, we found 150 program streams that were built up over the years, and we found that 90 of them actually overlapped. So it was overlapping like this. And every one of those streams had to have an audit, which was your taxpayers' money, and had compliance to go with it. So we said that's a bit crazy, so we reduced those programs to five, 150 to five. In that process, we saved $59 million just in paperwork. So that money could be reinvested and put it back into the system. There's a lot of fear about that because they said, oh, you just took 150 programs off us. No, we didn't. We just collapsed them and made a more efficient process into five. And so how can we focus on those areas? We also wanted to make sure that when we're looking at a lot of these areas, that we have an economic and commercial outcome. Because one of the things that we looked at was a missing space wasn't money, because the Productivity Commission was telling us that was about $5 to $6 billion spent annually on direct Indigenous funding, but another 30 billion was spent through other indirect programs such as education and health and so on. So that's nearly like $36 billion spent annually in Indigenous affairs. So we knew money wasn't the issue. The issue was where that money's being spent and how it's being spent and the wastage. A lot of that wastage was for government, and you look at housing as a good example. Housing, in the 2008 to 2014 period, we spent $5 billion on housing. And you sort of sit there and go, $5 billion in Indigenous housing, that's for 500,000 people. No, it wasn't. It was for remote area people, $5 billion. And we were building houses at the cost of $500,000 to $600,000 each. And within 10 years, as we knew, that those houses were going to have to be rebuilt again. So you sort of, so to me, just sitting here from above, that just didn't make any sense at all. So I went out and got a desktop review of that area through some investment bankers and venture capital type people as well as builders. And they come back and said that out of that $5 billion, $600 million was wasted through government administration. $600 million was wasted first. So you wonder what we could have done with that $600 million. So that's why we said, forget about money, let's focus on what are the outcomes that we want to achieve. And of course, that was to get kids to school, to get them educated, get their parents into jobs. And this is sort of like little motherhood statements, I suppose, and also to make their communities safe so people could live in those communities in a safe environment, people could visit those communities and be safe. It was one of the things that I find interesting in the discussion about Indigenous affairs is the incarceration rate which people are complaining about. And then they come over here and complain about the violence and abuse of women over here, not actually thinking they actually go together. And we need to bring those together if we're going to resolve a lot of these issues and stop pussyfooting around. So what we started to do is, okay, I've got a whole heap of stuff here, which the bureaucrats gave me as propaganda for the government, but one good thing about being an advisor, you don't have to be a propagandist for the government, you just need to advise. So my thinking in this space is that we need and actually one of the other jobs I'm doing at the moment, the Liberal government has appointed me to do the head inquiry into prisons, adult prisons, and re-offending in South Australia, which plays an incredible role about re-offending, because two-thirds of crime is actually by re-offenders. So if you can actually resolve the issue of re-offending, you can resolve the issue of incarceration rates, crime, and victims in that process. Not rocket science. Very sad. And there's only 2 years we have to focus on. The last 12 months of a person who's in incarceration to the first 6 months to 12 months are out, because that's when the reoffending happens. So dealing with those 2 years of periods is going to be a challenge for us, and we've got to do our report by December this year, and then the government's got to respond to that report by February 2017. So it's a lot of fun. So I'm bringing all those things together in this whole process of looking at this Indigenous restructuring. The areas that I noticed when I was, for my sins, I must have got drunk one night and I woke up as president of the Labor Party, was this idea of, when we talked about winning government or retaining government, we always talked about economic management. When we come to Indigenous affairs, we ought to be flipped over and started looking at welfare or funding services and stuff like that, rather than actually looking at what the outcomes are going to be. Are we going to bring down the crime rate in Aboriginal communities? Are we going to bring down the abuse and violence against Indigenous women? Are we going to lift the level of Indigenous people into jobs? We didn't talk about those things. So my background is one thing I use, as I said, I'm a very simple guy. I always loved Gantt charts and all this because that's my engineering background. And what we do is you have measurements, you have outcome. What are you going to achieve? When are you going to achieve it? So timelines. And how do you measure that achievement? And then you work out the budgets for it. So yeah, I think we'd start from the wrong end. We start from the end of the budget and we work out what we're going to do from there. In business and in the engineering trade, we go from the other end. What are we trying to achieve? How do you measure that and what are the timelines? And then you work out your budget from there. So one of the things we did, first things we did at the Indigenous Advisory Council, said everyone had to have an outcome. We just aren't going to fund you anymore just for the sake of funding because you're nice and seem to be doing a nice person doing a nice job. Show us the data of your job. What have you been doing for the last 12 months, 10 years, 15 years? And then we can if work with you about targets and outcomes that need to be achieved over the next 5 years and then go from there. Of course, the interesting thing about being in an advisory process is you also now and again get clubbed over the head with reality of budgets, and that's what happened to us in 2014 when our budgets were reduced. So then we, rather than complain about that, we said, okay, how can we rejig this to make sure we're going to get our outcomes? As far as I'm concerned, budgets will always go up and down, but we've still got to be heading for these targets and completing these targets within the timeframes. I also believe, so targets, measurements, outcomes, that's a new agenda. Also looking at dumping words, and one of the words I like to dump is welfare. I like to call it poverty. We are in the job of lifting people out of poverty. We're not in the welfare game. We're in people out there struggling in poverty. So I like to talk, so one of the things I want the government to do, it's going to be fun, is say, just forget about the word welfare and talk about poverty. So how do we lift people out of poverty? How do we build their lives? How do we get them to housing and education and health and so on like that? And disadvantage, call it poverty and disadvantage and work from that angle. And set targets, timeframes, measurements and accountability. One good thing about accountability is you always set targets, timeframes and measurements, but if no one's accountable, it never happens. I'll give an example. Indigenous procurement policy has been around for a number of years now, and has been getting only about $6 billion annually out into the Aboriginal business community on government contracts. Last year, we decided, working with the government, to make procurement officers, secretaries' departments, and their executive accountable for that. So they didn't meet their targets, they didn't meet their measurements, then they didn't get their pay rise. Very simple process, sort of a private sector process. Since the 1st of July 2015 to the 31st of May this year, the $6 billion annually going out to Indigenous businesses has gone up to $195 million in one 11-month period. We know for that process it has a flow-on effect because Indigenous, according to the Supply Nation, which is the Register of Indigenous Corporations, 70% of workers within Indigenous businesses are Indigenous. So the more Indigenous businesses we can create, the more people are going into jobs. Very simple. Very simple. I love that simple stuff. Very simple. We just set target. We ask simple questions, same as what I'm doing at the inquiry into prisons. Reoffend. I always find intellectuals and academics very funny because sitting there going, to me it's a very simple process. Warren Mundine's in jail today. Warren Mundine's out of jail tomorrow. And on Thursday, Warren Mundine's back in jail. We have 32 different ways of measuring that. To me, I just find that just bizarre. Just Warren Mundine's in jail, he's out of jail, he's in jail. Okay, that's very simple to me. So So we're trying to reform all that type of stuff. So, you know, and also in regard to school attendance, we've got to get more scientific about school attendance. Not just about just herding all the kids to school, but it's also dealing with the underlying issues of why they're not attending school. And trying to get data on the individualising those kids, which part of it I can understand is because of privacy issues, not that we can deal with the privacy issues, is so that we can actually say, oh, Warren Mundy's come to school Monday, but he didn't come to school for the rest of the week, you know, and we can actually track why he didn't do that. And the reason for that is a number of safety issues. One, we tracked a girl in Alice Springs, and she'd been missing from school for 3 months, so I actually found her. It's just a 15-year-old girl who'd been away from school for 3 months but was living in a caravan park with a 40-year-old man. Right? Safety issue. Very simple to track. So, then the other thing is then looking at, and you know, if it's a family, three or four kids in the same family, they're having the same issues, then you can check out what the problem is with the family. Is it drugs and alcohol? Are there work issues there? Domestic violence issues, a whole wide range of other stuff that you can deal with. So a very simple approach by just finding out whose kids come to school, when they come to school, and what it's all about. Now, they're the sort of simple type processes that we want to do. And we want to get real in a lot of areas. And that is that we want to, you know, our game is to lift people out of poverty and disadvantage. To do that, for remote and regional Australia, it isn't about the mining industry, it isn't about large agricultural industry, but the fact of the matter is about 70% of people who get employed in rural and remote Australia who are Indigenous, non-Indigenous, and small to medium businesses. How do we encourage those things to happen? We have to deal with the violence in the communities, then attracting investment. I spend a lot of time with, he's got a tough life, I think, sitting around talking to investment bankers is a real fun game, I tell you. So I sit around investing, trying to get investment, looking at these areas, doing the education, school attendance, and looking about how we can transfer this procurement policy across. We predict the way it's going at the moment is that by 2020 there'll be $1.2 billion of federal government contract going to Aboriginal businesses. If we get the state and territory governments to do the same, and we get some of the local governments to do the same, that figure will go up to about nearly $2 billion. You add the corporate sector into that, and that's another $2 billion on top of that, and that's $4 billion. So that's $4 billion for an exercise which doesn't cost government or the private sector any extra money, really. It does cost a little bit, but not much. So it's going to give those contracts out anyway. So it's very simple. Simple process about how we should be doing all these things. And of course we need to look at a wide range of other areas for these activities and that to happen. The big thing in which slapped me in the face, this is where I'm hoping you don't all rush the stage and beat me up now, is your comment earlier about the policies. You put the policies up on in the wall and about, well, where's the women's programs? It's just really, you do become unconscious to a lot of these things. Because we think we're doing a great service here and also focusing on the violence in women, which we are focusing very much on. But this issue of unconscious bias really reminded me, and I'm going to get beaten up by my wife when I go home, is because she's actually brought it up with me, because I made the fatal mistake of marrying a mergers and acquisition lawyer. And so if I ever get divorced, I'll be naked on the street. But the issue for me is that in all that process, you do have this unconscious bias, and you forget. And we thought we were writing really good policies and doing really good stuff until I looked on the board today. And it sort of hit home to me that we actually hadn't done that. So now, and I'm not a bloke who necessarily believes in quotas, but you just got to do them sometimes. You know, I'm sick of people saying, we'll do this job, we'll give it on merit. You give it on merit. You're telling me there's not a woman out there who on merit can do this job. I got sick and tired of that when I was president of the ALP, is to say, oh no, we only want women and they're here in merit. And I looked around the parliament, federal parliament, state parliaments, and I used to think to myself, half the blokes in this room, you wouldn't even think. You're telling me that no women out there who can give on merit and beat them. And that's so that's why I'm a supporter of quotas now. I've changed my view on that, because we've just got to smash through the roof and make things happen. And I've got to go and smash myself up later now to work out how I'm going to get women in this policy. Thank you.
Warren, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for your candour about unconscious bias. And to me, that's a beautiful example of the efficacy of dialogue, bringing people into a room and having a conversation where we have an environment of trust and exchange of ideas. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this special podcast from Broad on Joy 94.9 at the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, held at the Novotel in Collins Street, Melbourne. It ran from the 5th to the 6th of September 2016. And thanks to the United Nations Association of Australia and Sophie Arnold.
Bombastic, audacious, revolutionary, rash, outraged, organised, assertive activist days.
Broad.
On Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.